From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the November 2018 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Eastcote, from GCNCS to GCHQ. In this month's It Happened Here, we're marking 75 years since the establishment of Eastcote Outstation, the site at which bomb machines were operated from the autumn of 1943. By 1945, over 100 machines were at Eastcote, along with over 800 Wrens and RAF technicians and a small group of American GIs. But how did it start, and what was life there really like? As usual, we're joined by Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, why are we looking at Eastcote this month?
We're looking at Eastcote this month because the autumn of 1943, 75 years ago, was when the outstation, as it's called, at Eastcote first got going.
What do you mean by outstations?
The term outstation was specifically applied to locations where bomb machines were kept. And as the name implies, most of them weren't at Bletchley Park. Ironically, one of the outstations, as it's called, is Bletchley Park itself. But they use the term because the area where bomb machines were kept in Height 11 and subsequently Height 11A was known as an outstation because it had bombs in it. But the other five exist in other places.
Are they still part of GCNCS?
Yes, they're very much part of GCNCS. And the staff who worked at them, when you look at the tables of staff for GCNCS, they always get included. So they were considered to be an integral part of GCNCS. Unlike the Y stations, which are administered separately, the bomb out stations are very much in the organisational heart of GCNCS, even though they're not physically located here on the site of Bletchley.
So when we see the numbers working at GCNCS growing and growing, the bomb out stations are part of that?
Yes, up to about 2,000 of those people are Wrens and RAF personnel at out stations.
We're looking specifically at Eastcote. Why was Eastcote chosen as a place to put an outstation?
Well, Eastcote comes quite late in the process with outstations because when the bombs were first designed in 1940, they built one or two and then it became obvious that having many, many more of these machines was really required. And they also took the decision that because they were very expensive bits of kit, that putting all their eggs in one basket and having them all in one building at Bletchley was potentially risky. It could get bombed or whatever. So they, from the outset, decided that they would disperse them in different locations. And in the early days, in March 1941, they looked at country houses near Bletchley, and both Adstock Manor and Wavendon House are taken over as bomb outstations. Adstock, they actually used the existing stable block of the house to put the bomb machines in. And then following year in September, Gayhurst is taken over as another one. The problem with this is each site can only take 10 or 15 machines. And through 1941 into 1942, it becomes apparent that putting them in sort of penny packets in different places is just an administrative nightmare in terms of staff billeting and managing their operation and everything else. So in the summer of 1942, Harold Fletcher of Fletcher's Bomb Book, the man who is in charge of the whole bomb operation, decides that for the future they need purpose-built large-scale sites where they can put large numbers of machines in one place. And the first one that comes about as a result of that is the outstation at Stanmore, which opens in November 1942. But like everything else at Bletchley Park, they figure out what they need, and by the time they've got it, they realise it wasn't big enough. So there is talk fairly early on of what's referred to as another Stanmore, basically reproducing the same idea somewhere else. They look at a whole range of sites. I mean, in this area, Stowe School over near Buckingham is looked at as a possible location. And it's quite interesting to think of how the story of Bletchley would be different if there was an outstation at Stowe. You know, it would change the story quite significantly. But in the end, that wasn't chosen. They had a location at Stanmore. And then in the summer of 1943, they identify this site at Eastcote. It already had suitable buildings on it because the government had acquired the land and built buildings very similar to the later blocks at Bletchley Park. But they didn't really know what they were going to be used for at that point. There was a suggestion there might be a hospital to support the Normandy invasion when it happened. But at that point in 1943, they were going begging. So GCNCS managed to acquire them. And it's from September in 1943 up until sort of Christmas 1943 when the first 10 bomb machines arrive at Eastcote and it gets going as an outstation proper.
It's quite interesting to see the parallel where at Bletchley Park, the site itself, obviously there was the existing mansion, people moved in, and then as it grew and grew, the blocks were built. How that's the parallel with the outstation. So older mansions and country houses such as Adstock and Wavendon were used. But at one point, that decision was then made to start building this more industrial approach through Stanmore and Eastcote.
There's definitely a sense in sort of 42, 43 that occupying existing buildings and sticking up temporary huts and things just isn't the solution, and that the war is big enough and it's going to go on long enough that you need to take a new approach and build large for the long term. And that's what both Stanmore and Eastcote really represent.
So you said that Eastcote was begun, it was being built in 43, that the first bombs moved in. What were the buildings at Eastcote? Did they build any more in order to accommodate these bombs, or did they use those original buildings that they'd put in?
There were some buildings there. To what extent the additional buildings were built, I'm not completely sure. We know what the site looked like because post-war maps exist, which basically the same buildings are there. And they look very much like the later blocks at Bletchley. So Block D that we have here, which is a long corridor building with spurs, as they're called, sticking off the sides of it. Eastcote had very similar buildings to that. There would be a long central corridor with spurs coming off the sides. The main block that had the bomb machines in it had, I think, 12 spurs, and then it had a wall around it. And then adjacent were similar blocks that were for the accommodation of the Wrens. So their working space and their sleeping space were, in terms of the buildings, more or less identical.
Keep it up, girls. Only 4 hours to go before supper. It has been a very long day, but you must not lose your concentration at any cost.
Hey, Amy, tea's up. Gordon Bennett, my eyes ache. These lights are so flicky. I don't know what's worse. The lights, the noise, the heat, or smelling of engine oil from morning till night. Now for a fine cup of Muzawati tea, made even more delicious and, orange, with the addition of tinned milk. Still, maybe it'll keep me going for the next 4 hours.
We've certainly heard veterans talking about when operating bombs, it was very, very noisy. Those buildings with 12 spurs full of bomb machines must have been a racket.
Oh, absolutely. It would have been a fairly grim place to work in that sense, that they were better than some of the early bomb buildings, which had almost no windows at all. But there would have been blackout a lot of the time. Also, at Eastcote, there was a blast wall built around the block that contained all the machines. So even if you could look out of the window, you'd just seen brickwork about 6 feet away. You wouldn't have had a view. And it certainly would have been very noisy. There had been a huge amount going on. But by 1945, they have over 100 machines running in there, 10 per spur, and 10 spurs with bomb machines, and the other two have admin offices in. But it would have been clattering, clanking smells.
I was sent straight to Eastcote. I was put on to Sea Watch. I had to report the next morning, and I was allotted a place to sleep, which was two-tier bunks. There were 72 of us in a room. What is that? 36 bunks. Next morning, I was told to report to Block B. Well, now, Block B was where we worked, and that was quite separate from Block A, where we lived. And I went over to Block B, which was behind a very, very high brick wall. You couldn't see inside at all. It was right round the outside of it. And we had to go through there were guards on the door, and they inspected. We were given special passes. I was given a special pass to get in. And they looked at our passes when we went in and when we came out every single time, although we got to know them, know quite a lot of them, but they always had to go through that performance. It had to be so strict. And we were taken into a room there, and Oliver Lorne, just remembered his name, from Bletchley Park, came down and he talked to us about what we were going to do. And it was only then we knew it was finding out the settings so that they could break the codes. I was put onto one of these machines with somebody else, and we were trained. We had to be trained, of course, learn all about it, how to do it, and the problems, and because there were a lot of possibilities for shorts on these machines because of the drums and the little wires they had for each, whole bunch of wires for each letter of the alphabet. And if one of those little wires got bent and touched another wire, it shorted everything and the machine would come to a halt and we get a wrong stop. And it was very difficult to keep them absolutely straight, you know, and so on. You had to learn to work out from a plan that came from Bletchley Park the best way to wire up the back of the machine, which was left to you to work it out the best way possible. And there were different ways you could have done it, and it was complicated. And then we were told what colour drums to use for the front of the machine for each time we did a programme. And it took some time to wire up the back and to put the drums onto the front, all in proper order. And they all had a starting position, which you had to get to. And then when it was all done, you set the machine off, started it off, and it clicked round. They all made a dreadful noise in this room, all these machines. It's terrible, terrible noise. I can still hear it now, really. And if the machine stopped, it could be one of two things. Either you'd, well, broken the code or broken the means of breaking the code, and that set of letters worked, or there was a fault on the machine, a short, which was a nightmare, as I say, checking every drum with all these little wires. It was a nightmare, something we all dreaded all the time. You do the program through, sometimes you go the whole way through and it wouldn't stop at all, very often, but more often than not. But you tested it all the possibilities. And when you'd done that, or else you'd got a stop which was the right stop and Bletchley Park had rung back, job up, you then stripped the machine as quickly as you could and you were given another program and you started on that one. The pressure was enormous for an 18-year-old, 19-year-old woman. It was really was enormous, and it took me a long time after the war to get over it, really, and I'm sure it did everybody else. I met people who kept in touch with one or two, and they said the same. It was terribly stressful. I don't think people realise.
With all these blast walls and all this noise coming within the buildings, would members of the public passing by have just seen this distant campus almost, or was it something that members of the public would have been able to approach or come near?
Well, one of the quirky features of Eastcote is that the site they acquired, which was the grounds of Eastcote House, which is a country house just nearby, had an existing footpath running across the middle of it. And English law being what it is, even a war didn't stop the footpath. So the right of way was retained. And on one side, you'd have had a big chain link fence, and inside it, this blast wall that contained the bomb building itself. And that wouldn't have looked like anything at all. All you'd have seen was a blank wall. But then there was a gate and there was a crossing of the footpath and another gate. And on the other side were another two spur buildings, which were the Wren's accommodation. But they weren't protected by blast walls, so they would have been visible. And if you were walking your dog down the path, every 8 hours, you'd have seen several hundred wrens crossing from one side to the other.
So members of the public could just walk through Eastcote Outstation, as it
yes.
was?
Yes, I mean, they would be going down a kind of tunnel of fence on either side, but they were literally crossing through the middle.
Goodness.
And there was two guard posts about 10 feet apart on either side of the path, and you'd come out and you'd show your pass. When you came out of the accommodation building, you'd walk 10 feet, you'd show your pass to go into the work building and vice versa.
When we were on night duty, we used to come over at 3 o'clock for a meal, only a little light meal. And often we had to come over singly because we had to get somebody to look after the machine You couldn't leave it for too long, and they couldn't send the whole lot of us over together, so we just went over singly. We did go over together if we could, because it had become known that there was a man who was loitering along the pathway, which was between Block B, where we worked, and Block A, where we lived. We had to come back to Block A for our meal, and cross this pathway in the middle of the night on our own. And for an 18, 19-year-old girl, it wasn't very nice. I never did see the man. I did vaguely see some people once or twice in the night along the path, which I thought was strange at that time at night. But I ran fast as my legs would go. Directly I got out of Block B and through past the guards, I ran, and it was pitch dark. You couldn't have lights, or you didn't have street lights or anything in wartime. And you just hope that, you know, there's enough moonlit night to see. And I ran at top speed over to Block A for my meal, and then the same when I went back. If I could pair up with anybody else, I did.
You've mentioned a little bit about the working conditions, that it would have been a little bit grim. We know that operating bombs was quite a difficult, quite a physical job, about the noise, about the working conditions there, from what our veterans have told us. Would the bomb bays at Eastcote have had a similar feel to the bomb huts, for example, Hut 11 at Bletchley Park?
I think it would have been a very similar feel, certainly in the bays that are running the more conventional bombs. You also have a bay at Eastcote that's running the Cobra 4 rotor machines, and they would have been quite a different sensation, because part of that machine is a conventional bomb, but the other part is the Cobra attachment, it was called, which had these very fast spinning drums on it that would have been a whole different level of unpleasantness in a different way, if you like. They probably made an entirely different noise. And in fact, they produced so much dust from their carbon and brass components when they were spinning at high speed that they actually had to build a wall between the Cobra attachment and the rest of the bomb, because the dust would get in the works of the other half of the machine and gum it up. So not a brilliant bit of kit. And in the end, they only built about a dozen of them and went on to the high-speed Keane machines, it was called, the other four-rotor bomb, which was more reliable.
How many bombs were there in total at Eastcote?
By the end of the war, there are 103, but that figure is only reached in 1945. The times we're talking about 75 years ago now, in late 43, they had 10 by Christmas. That was out of about 99 in service by that point. The others would have been at Stanmore and at the Country House outstations and here at Bletchley. But by the end of 1945, there are 103 at Eastcote out of 211 total. So more or less half the entire stock of bomb machines is on this one site.
And was it only bombs being operated at Eastcote? Was that its sole purpose?
Yes, bombs and checking machines. That was its sole purpose.
So was it mostly staffed by Wrens?
Yes. At peak, there were over 800 Wrens there. Because if you imagine each machine needs two Wrens to operate it, three shifts, that's six women, a couple of spares for leave and sickness and things. You basically need 8 to 10 people per machine. A workforce of 800 is about right for 100 machines.
And as with the other locations where bombs were the mechanics and the people fixing them RAF?
Yes, male RAF personnel would do the maintenance.
Eastcote would have felt quite like a small town or a community or a village.
I think the Navy would prefer that it felt like a ship. That's how the Navy tries to run things, even if they're on land. And veterans describe how the whole place was run under naval discipline. Everybody had to wear their uniform all the time. They had what's called divisions in the Navy, which is basically a parade where everybody turns out and you count everyone, check they're all there. Also, in the accommodation blocks, each spur of the accommodation block was named after a different ship in the Navy. So they were sleeping in wings named after different ships. So that would have given it an even more kind of nautical flavour. And they were referred to as bunks, and the toilets were heads, and they had all the kind of naval terminology like that.
So the timetables would have been strictly watches.
Yes, and they were referred to as watches. And all. So it was very much the Navy running its, well, I was going to say running its own ship, but that's exactly what they were doing. Although many of the veterans say that Eastcote was much better than, for example, Woburn Abbey, because at Woburn, the Wrens living there were doing all sorts of different kinds of jobs. Some of them were working day shifts in the naval section, others were running bombs, others were doing bits and pieces. And it meant that in any one dormitory, people were on different shifts and no one could get any sleep because people were getting out of bed at all crazy times of day and night. At Eastcote, because it was a fairly uniform task, they were all doing the same job, they were able to allocate each shift to one set of spurs in the accommodation, which meant that everyone in your room was on your shift and was getting up at the same time as you and going to bed at the same time as you, even if across the corridor they were on a different shift, which it sounds quite a small thing, but if you have to spend 2 years on shift, not having people coming in the middle of the night is going to be quite important.
Yeah. Am I right that there were also US personnel at Eastcote?
Yes. Certainly in later 1944 and into 1945, the programme that we talked about in the last podcast where all the Americans came over, one of those signal sections are given a bay at Eastcote, and it's known as USA Bay, and all of the bomb machines in there have names of US cities. So there would have been Americans in there as well. But they weren't allowed to live on site with the Wrens.
Where were they?
They were in a tented camp in Ruislip Woods, which must have been rather more primitive.
Absolutely. But, not enormously comfortable.
Yeah, the RAF mechanics were trusted to live on the site, but not the GIs.
Listen to them all. Clickety-click. All those wheels whirling round, and you're just recording the stops. It's like churning blooming butter on a hot day. Eventually, though, the butter will come, and the messages can be decoded, and lots of lives will be saved. If not, probably someone's had it.
Is there anything in particular you found that Wrens remember from their life at Eastcote?
Well, one of the things that struck a chord with me, because of the various jobs I've had, is Eastcote was one of the few parts of Bletchley Park where they introduced timesheets. And we know how much everyone hates timesheets. But with that many bombs running and that many staff operating them, Hut 6 felt it was really important to have a system as efficient as possible. And so they needed to monitor how long it took to run each job, how quickly it was possible to change the rotors on the machines. And so they needed data. And the way they decided to do this was to make every Wren, in addition to doing her job, to fill in a timesheet every day, which said how many rotors she changed, how many runs she'd done, whether they'd been successful, etc., etc. And this has a wonderfully modern ring to it because everybody is familiar with not only doing their job, but then having to fill in a timesheet. And it was as unpopular then as it is now.
I can imagine.
So there was a certain amount of paperwork. This also led on to the issuing of bulletins for the staff. They introduced a thing called the technical data sheet, which was as exciting as it sounds. And the idea of this was that if there were particular ways you needed to operate the machine or particular sort of hints and tips to make it more efficient, this was how the Wrens would get that information. The trouble was it was really boring. And what it evolved into was a thing called the Pages Gazette. And the Pages Gazette was a magazine that contained the technical information and the sort of staff notices that the Wrens needed. But they were also able to contribute their own material to it. So it had poetry in it, it had jokes in it and things like that. And it was actually quite a good idea because it got people reading the document in the first place. So they might pick up some of the technical information that if you'd just given them a dry kind of staff update, wouldn't have been as interesting. It's called the Pages Gazette because if you take the initials of the remaining outstations, which is P for Park, as in Bletchley Park, A for Adstock, G for Gayhurst, E for Eastcote, and S for Stanmore, you get Pages.
So this was distributed amongst all the outstations, yes, rather than just Eastcote.
Yes.
Right.
And apparently they managed to produce 4 editions of this before VE Day. Sadly, I've not been able to identify any of them. I think it would be a fascinating thing to have a look at.
Absolutely.
Especially the sort of the Wren's own contributions rather than necessarily the technical bits.
Well, it's nice to think as well, there may have been a sense that they weren't just isolated and just their one unit in that one place, that there were other places doing similar things to them.
And this spirit seemed to have persisted because there was an old Eastcote association as well. A number of people worked there post-war, but a lot of the wartime personnel were involved with that as well. I mean, you dug out some copies of that, didn't you?
There's some magazines still existing. We have one on display, actually, in the Hut 11A, the Bomb Breakthrough exhibition. Some of this month's Collections Uncovered, number 10, looks at the material from that old Eastcote association magazine, looking at poetry and imagery from it.
I'm here with our museum archivist, Guy Revel, again. And we're going to talk about our latest release of Collections Uncovered from the archive, which ties in with this month's episode about Eastcote. So, Guy, can you take us through some of what's in this month's collection?
Yeah, so these are items from the archive collection. We've got four photographs which show a group photograph of the Wrens, or some of the Wrens rather, who were the individuals that ran the bomb machines at Eastcote. We've got a group photograph of the RAF mechanics, who were the people who fixed the machines and serviced them if anything went wrong with them. There was a mixed men's and female hockey team.
Oh, really?
Yes, and we, in fact, because of the annotations on the reverse, know the identities of all but one of those individuals, which is slightly unusual.
So this was in their free time?
Yes, that's correct. Obviously, it's not an official part of their job.
No.
They had to have some activities for downtime. So as well as the hockey, we have an example of one of the programmes for a performance that they put on in a local school. But they obviously were entertaining themselves in the creation and the production of this particular performance. And it, not just the people on stage, but also people doing the wardrobe, lighting, things like that.
So we know about that at Bletchley Park with the Drama Society here, but they were actually doing that at Eastcote as well.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, one of the performances put on at Bletchley was by the staff at Eastcote who came to Bletchley to entertain the staff who were here.
Oh, really?
Yes, that's performance combined operations or combined ops. And the other photograph that we have is a rather striking portrait of Rachel Morley, who was a Wren who was at Eastcote.
And then we've got some documents as well, haven't we? And one of these has been quite important, really, hasn't it?
Yes, it's a Christmas menu for 1944 for the United States Army Detachment, which was at Eastcote, because the United States had its own section, its own wing. The particular interest that we have in this document is that it lists all of the individuals who were part of the unit at the time of the Christmas dinner. And we've been able to use that to enhance our roll of honour, where we try to record the service of everyone who qualifies as part of British Signals Intelligence Organisation during the Second World War. So we added roughly 100 names of individuals who we hadn't known of before to the roll of honour.
A lot of people don't realise is when the museum was set up, we didn't know who'd served here. And we still don't really know who served here. In a lot of cases, we rely on people to tell us. Because there weren't records kept, were they? So this is really important for the archive, isn't it?
That's correct. There was no role of people who came to work at Bletchley or its outstations, such as Eastcote.
Jonathan, our oral history officer, has spoken about this in the past, where there's literally six pages that were put together by GCHQ of double-spaced typing, full scap, and that was the list of people they kind of guessed had worked at Bletchley Park, because they were trying to put together teams in sort of 1948 or something, weren't they?
And that would probably be a snapshot in time as well. So not for the duration of the entire war, where people could have come in later on, or some individuals, in fact, left once they'd arrived.
And even in that document, there's doubles, because you get someone remembers that, for example, Gene Smith worked here, and someone says, oh, well, there was Gene Arnold who worked here, and it turns out, you know, the ladies got married at some point. They've
That's
used
correct,
their maiden
yes.
name. We rely on little snippets of information like this to update that roll of honour, don't we?
Yeah, the roll of honour is definitely a living beast. It can probably never be complete, but adding around 100 names in one go was certainly...
That's remarkable.
Yes.
Let's just run through another couple of the documents that we've released this month.
Two of them are actually pages from a single book, or a booklet rather. There's the front cover for the Eastcote Association magazine, and within that, they had a poem called OSE, which is Outstation Eastcote, which is how they would refer to it. It's OSE Fever.
OSE Fever by H. Newton and C. Campbell, with apologies to John Masefield. I must go back to Eastcote again, to the busy bays and the laughter, and all I ask is an evening watch with thoughts of sleep soon after, and the wheels click and the motor's song and the typewriter's chattering, and the thankful look on everyone's face when T-boat comes clattering. I must go back to Eastcote again, for the call of the running machine is a wide call and a clear call that will remain evergreen. And all I ask is a trouble-free day with the relief watch arriving, and the evening free, the RAF hall full, and everyone jiving. I must go back to Eastcote again, to the communal way of life, to the Wren's way and the RAF's way, where Dissett's a discarded wife. And all I ask are pretty wrens, like the ones that came from Dover, and quiet sleep and sweet dreams when the night watch is over.
So what was this magazine? Because this says 1946 on it.
So this, we believe, we've only got the one example, was a sort of Old Boys and Girls Association magazine by which they could keep in touch and reminisce after they'd left the service and Eastcote had ceased to have the role that it was having during the war.
How would they have done this? Because they wouldn't have known who...
Probably the individuals who were present at the time of shutdown. They would have become friends over the course of their service, yeah. And they would have exchanged contact details and they would have written to each other, and that would have formed the basis of the individuals who were contributing to and receiving the magazine.
So this wasn't official, was it?
This is generated by the people who had been at Eastcote.
And is this rare or...?
It's not rare in terms of something that happens in the services. Slightly more rare, as you might imagine, in the secret world of signals intelligence. But there was another publication called The Nosy Parker, which was an annual news sheet which ran from at least 46 to 1958, which helped people who were at Bletchley keep in touch with each other.
No. Really?
Yeah, it's almost like a very short version of that Christmas letter that people used to write to long-lost relatives. Such and such is doing well, our son has gone to university, etc., etc.
Well, I've never heard of that. I've been involved with Bletchley for, I think, 8 years now. Is that one of your favourite parts of this job, the research? So something like that turns up that we don't know about, and that opens a completely new path of research, doesn't it?
Very much so, and it's also more of the social and human aspect of what went on at Bletchley and its outstations. A lot of the initial publications were about the technical side of things and the impact and what happened, less about the people who made those things happen, whereas this is very much more human.
So something coming up like that just takes you off on a new path of research, doesn't it? And the more of these things that come in, I suppose there are more paths that we can follow, can't we, to tell the story?
Yeah, that's very true. The official records, of course, won't really touch on the mass of the individuals, whereas that's what these types of records are based around. It's what's happening to the individuals who served here, rather than the output of their work, which is what the official histories will look at.
Our core mission statement here is to tell the stories of the people who worked here, and that's what this is helping to do, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm not sure how many people knew before we put it out this month that there was a mixed hockey team at Eastcote, for example.
No. And you wouldn't have expected that in the 1940s, would you?
It wouldn't be the first thing you think of, no. I mean, you might expect there to be a male team and a female team, but I was surprised to see that there was a mixed one.
With these quite difficult working conditions that they had with this naval or military regimen that the Wrens and the RAF had to live under, what on earth did they do to relax or to get away from it all?
Well, we have to remember, and we've touched on this several times in the podcast now, that these were mostly young women, 18, 19, 20 years old, and they were a spirited bunch. And so despite all of the naval discipline, they were quite prepared to find their way out and about to enjoy themselves where they could. The simplest way to relax was in Eastcote and Ruislip itself. There were cafes where they would go and just have some decent food, because the food at Eastcote, everybody says it was terrible. The food at Woburn was terrible as well. So you get the sense that naval cookery was not quite up to the standard of Bletchley Park cookery. So they would go out and they talk about going for kind of coffee and beans on toast and simple pleasures like that. They were also quite close to central London. And so if they wanted to go out and get theatre tickets or go clubbing or whatever, it was relatively easy to do. In fact, one of the concerns expressed by Bletchley Park management about Eastcote and Stanmore is its proximity to London, on the basis that the staff might have distractions. They clearly did have distractions, but they also clearly were able to make it back to work. We mentioned the Americans as well earlier. There's a lovely story from one of the veterans about the fact that Eastcote House, which was still standing just adjacent to the site, had a swimming pool. And some of the Americans suggested that the Wrens might like to go swimming in the middle of the night. And this lady describes putting on a swimming costume in her bunk, putting a raincoat over the top, climbing out of the window and going off in the middle of the night, going swimming with these Americans and then sneaking back in again. Which gives you a sense of, you know, how adventurous some of them were.
So there was discipline, but there was also a relatively good time to be had as well.
I think so, yes.
It was fairly close to London. Obviously, there is the risk of attack with its proximity to London. London, as we know, was bombed. Was Eastcote ever a target?
It wasn't deliberately targeted. I don't think the Germans were ever aware specifically that it was there or what it was doing. And it also got set up quite late in the war. But in the sort of resurgence of the bombing campaign in 1944, it did get struck by accident. In February 1944, a German bomber dropped incendiary bombs across the site, and various bits of it were set on fire in the middle of the night. And what's noticeable about it is that the ARP and the fire service all turned out and rushed across there and found wrens with hoses and brooms and things basically dealing with the whole situation because they'd been trained for this kind of thing. They'd been selected because they were the kind of the women who wouldn't be fazed by this sort of thing. And so they successfully put out all the fires on the Eastcote side itself and then deployed off the site to go and put out the fires in local people's houses as well.
Wow.
So it didn't cause an enormous amount of disruption and work was able to continue quite quickly. One of the veterans also describes once people started squirting hoses around and there was water everywhere, some of the wags on site started shouting "abandon ship" and things like that. So I don't think they all found it too terrifying. I think they thought it was just something else to talk about. The other outstation in London, Stanmore, things got a little bit more serious in December 1944 when a V1 landed within 100 yards of the site. That, again, there was a big blast wall around the bomb building and the people who were in the building remember the shockwave being sufficient to break some of the glass in the windows and to raise an enormous amount of dust. Which, of course, you're concerned about dust if you run a bomb machine.
Yeah, it definitely.
Clogs the thing up. But again, no significant injuries, although people do describe kind of being thrown to the floor and getting up and going, what on earth was that? So it was never attacked deliberately, but like anything else, like Bletchley Park itself, Bletchley Park was bombed by accident at one point. So the threat wasn't completely absent.
Oh, I think you mentioned before the war ended, you actually bombed. There were bombs dropped on...
Eastcote, when they dropped a Molotov bread basket on us.
A Molotov bread basket?
That was the nickname for them at the time. It was a great big container like this, and it was full of incendiary bombs, and it was altitude primed, so the natural fact at a certain altitude, the thing would open and scatter them all over the place. And once you start the fires going, you see, then you could drop the high explosives and blow everything
up.
But it was very low, in fact. He was very low when they dropped it. And so some of the incendiary bombs came out, but the main great big container with the remainder of the incendiary bombs was dropped on our hut.
So you weren't in a shelter? I mean, didn't you get any
warning? Oh, never went into a shelter.
You never got any warning?
No, well, the raid was on, yeah.
All right.
We were in bed. There was no question of going to a shelter. I never went into an air raid shelter in my life.
Good Lord.
We heard this aircraft, it was coming lower and lower. Everybody knew the sound of a German aircraft. Their engine sounded different from ours.
They were unsynchronized.
Yeah. And that's when Sheila said to me, let's get under the bedclothes. And the next moment there was this enormous bang! And it came down. The two huts were together, but open down the middle with all the pipework and all the rest of it. And if it had landed, as far as from you to me here, I'd have been dead. It was so close, and it pulled all this down. As I say, there was absolute silence. Sound of water pouring, and then some wag shouting out, abandoned ship. It looked like one of these wartime films about ships being torpedoed, you know?
Abandoned hut.
And we clambered up over it.
Over the bomb?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
And the rubbish and the roof that had come down. Yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned flying bombs.
Oh, the little bugs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were close to one of those.
Well, yeah, they were all coming over all the time when I was at Stanmore after D-Day. And this one came lower. I had gone to bed and Sheila was down on the ablution block. And this one came lower now than ever heard, and the engine stopped. And because they were ramjets, once the engine stopped, straight down. I remember with my bare feet in a pair of some pyjamas running down the concrete corridor saying, I don't want to die by myself. And joined Sheila, who was already on the floor, like this, you know. And we waited. Nothing happened. And that one glided and landed in Mill Hill about 5 miles away.
In 1945, the war came to an end. What happened at Eastcote at that point?
Well, the war ended quite suddenly, certainly for the Wrens at Eastcote, because on VE Day, all of the bombs were basically switched off. And a decision was made very rapidly to dismantle most of them. And so many of the Wrens remember the war ending and a little bit of celebration and then going back to work to just start unbolting bits and breaking solder and taking the machines apart.
So they dismantled and destroyed. They were never dismantled for transport or for storage.
Well, they kept a few. They kept 50 at that point. GCNCS was obviously going to continue after the war. You know, the Cold War against the Russians was already building in 1945. And the organisation existed pre-war, so obviously it had a permanent character, but it was obviously going to be a lot smaller. And so they started to scale down the operation. And initially they took the decision that they would close Eastcote and keep Stanmore. And so a lot of the stuff at Eastcote was stripped out and moved to Stanmore. They then reversed that decision and decided to keep Eastcote instead, so it all had to be shifted back again. But for the Wrens there, the experience was basically of breaking up the bomb machines for recycling, because they included a lot of valuable components and metals that could be recycled. Mm-hmm. So they were taking them apart. Some bomb machines were restarted because they were still listening to Abwehr traffic and breaking backlog Abwehr traffic, because there was a concern that the Germans might have resistance organisations that they'd sort of established to fight on after the surrender. Certainly in Britain, there'd been the whole underground thing, so that if we got invaded, people would come out of the woodwork and carry on fighting. So there was still work to do on that side, but most of those machines were at Bletchley anyway, they weren't at Eastcote.
Well, I was a bomb operator at Eastcote on Sea Watch. Sea Watch was actually on duty when they announced VE Day. So it stopped the following day. The chief officer gave us all a little pep talk. Well, I think she thought we were all going to lose our honour because of everybody feeling free and throwing away caution to the winds and celebrating and drinking. She was, oh, woman, it's been terrible for her. And we all rushed up to London and throwing the crowds there outside the palace, shouting and marching them down Piccadilly with about 20 Canadian Air Force officers all arm in arm. Had a marvellous day. And then we slept in the YWCA Baker Street, which we always did. Came back to Eastcote the next day, and it must have been the following day then that we then sat outside. There was a heat wave. Sat outside and smashed up the bombs. Well, didn't actually smash them. The Air Force boys, who were GCHQ engineers, they had dismantled the big things, and we had all the small stuff and all these hundreds of drums. We had to take them apart. Everything was counted, screws and bearings and so on.
Did that make you feel, oh, what have we been doing?
No, no, that made we were all happy. That was it. It was the end of it.
About 50 machines were retained, of which 16 initially were kept running and the others were greased up and mothballed. When I started looking into the story of the bomb machines, we were really unclear what had happened to the remaining 50 machines after 1945. Even the historian at GCHQ was constantly asked and constantly had to reply, we know we haven't got any now, but we don't know why that is. We don't know what happened to them. Interestingly, just last Christmas, he came across some documentation that he wasn't looking for, the way that always happens in archives. And he found some paperwork from 1959 describing how the remaining bombs had been taken to Corsham, to the underground bunker at Corsham, and stored there for effectively another 15 years. But in 1959, they decided they were now completely obsolete and the remaining ones were demolished.
So no bombs survive.
So no British bombs survive, which is a shame.
You said they moved everything to Stanmore and then they moved back to Eastcote.
Yes, this is because Bletchley Park had only been a war station for GCNCS. They decided that it wasn't practical to keep the organisation at Bletchley, and at least some of their operation they wanted nearer London. And Eastcote provided a great site for GCNCS, or GCHQ as it is now known.
When was it first known as GCHQ?
It's quite early on. It's 1939 when that acronym first appears as a cover name for the organisation, although its official, albeit secret, title was still Government Code and Cipher School, and only later becomes the official name of the organisation. But like many secret organisations, they don't necessarily have one official title. They have all sorts of names by which they're known. So in 1945 into 1946, the whole organisation contracts from Bletchley and the other outstations and everywhere else into the Eastcote site. And they stay there as GCHQ until the early 1950s, at which point they move to Cheltenham, which is where the organisation is now.
So what happened with the site after they'd moved to Cheltenham?
Well, it remained in government hands. And again, a bit like Bletchley, various different tenants moved in and out, occupying the site. Interestingly, the US forces had it for quite a long time. The US Marine Corps used it as a headquarters for their protection units, which are the people that look after American embassies and consulates and things. NCIS, of television fame, also had an office at Eastcote for a while, up until the 1980s. But like all these places, the buildings weren't necessarily designed to survive long term. And in 2008, the whole place was demolished and replaced with housing.
Oh, looks like we've got some results. Hello, this is Greece. We've got a good stop on Athens. The letters are O, U, G and L. I've just got to wait now. I'm going to London on my next free weekend. Theatre, film, all cut price for service folk. I'm going to see Sid Field and hear Zoe Gale sing. I'm going to get lit up when the lights go out in London.
Job up. Job up, girls. At last. Well done. Strip the machine down as fast as you can. You're moving on to the next menu.
Job up, Amy. Prayers answered. We got the right settings. Now, please, give it to them, lads.
Does any of it remain at all?
There are no buildings surviving, but the presence of the site is recorded in the street names.
For example?
Well, one of the roads is named after the Lady Superintendent of all the Wrens, Edith Blagrove, so we have Blagrove Crescent. Tommy Flowers is recorded in Flowers Avenue. He's famous for the Colossus machine, but he also worked on the Cobra and the four-rotor bomb machines, so he is part of the Eastcote story. And there's also Wren Lane, so there is a vestige of the wartime story preserved there, if not physically. And the local Eastcote Historical Society are very aware of the story and very keen to promote it, and so they have on their website stuff about it. And it's definitely part of the local history of the area. And that society also went on to produce a physical memorial on the site as well. So that records the nearly 3,000 Wrens who worked on bomb operations, not all at Eastcote.
So its presence is still felt in the area?
Oh, very much so, yes.
The Worshipful, the Mayor and Mayoress of Hillingdon, Councillor Catherine Dan and Mrs. Rita Kilroy, local councillors, ladies and gentlemen, may I first welcome you all to this unveiling ceremony. And thank you all so much for coming along to formally recognise the invaluable contribution made by the hundreds of people that worked on this site during the war and after the war. During World War II, the largest of the five outstations of the now very famous Bletchley Park was based here. It was known as HMS Pembroke 5 and housed over 100 bomb machines, as they were called, which were used for testing all the potential settings of the German Enigma machines. The bombs were operated by 800 Wrens with the help of 100 RAF technicians. They all worked around the clock, 7 days a week. It was hard, physical, tedious work, calling for great accuracy and concentration while working under intense pressure. At the end of the war, those same Wrens were responsible for dismantling the bombs, since it was considered imperative that the operation should still remain secret. The site then continued to play an important role in the security of the country when in 1946 it became the Government Communications Headquarters, or GCHQ. And GCHQ remained here until the relocation of most of its departments to Cheltenham in the 1950s. When the MOD announced 10 years ago that it was selling the site for development, several of the members of the Eastcote Residents Association and the Ruislip Northwood and Eastcote Local History Society were determined that the importance of the site should be recognised. Today, the memorial plaque that is going to be unveiled will provide a permanent reminder of the history for all to read. I hope this history has allowed you to appreciate the real significance of this site, and I would now like to hand you over to the Mayor of Hillingdon, Councillor Catherine Dan, for the unveiling.
Thank you very much, Chris, and thank you to all of you for coming. In addition to our local councillors and representatives of a number of local organisations, we're very pleased to have with us today some people representing organisations that were involved in the history of this site. We have Mark Cotton, and Jonathan Byrne of the Bletchley Park Trust, which is the organisation whose mission is to preserve and develop Bletchley Park, and also to enhance the understanding of the critical contribution of code-breaking and intelligence in World War II, and how these unique achievements remain relevant today. Andrea Wrigley and a group of ex-friends, representatives of GCHQ, who were much thanked for all the help they have given in providing background information. Many other people who cannot be here today have provided masses of information detailing what it was like to work here. These have included ex-Wrens who served here during the war, and people like Russell Barnes, who spent his national service years working at Eastcote for GCHQ. Their reminiscence now form an important local history archive for future generations. We welcome representatives of the past armed forces, represented here today by the Eastcote branch of the Royal British Legion. We would also like to thank the developers Taylor Wimpey, particularly their current site representative, John Byrne, for their support and generosity in providing the plinth, and also the Eastcote Residents Association, who have assisted in providing this monument. Lastly, a big thank you to the Ruislip, Northwood and Eastcote Local History Society for all their efforts in seeing this whole project through to completion. I unveil this plaque in memory of the hundreds of unsung heroes whose valiant work at HMS Pembroke 5 made a very significant contribution to World War II, and also in memory of all the staff at GCHQ who worked here.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.